This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll track the devastating Alberta wildfire with University of Wisconsin meteorologist.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Donald Trump made big headlines this week when he became the presumptive GOP presidential nominee after Ted Cruz and John Kasich suspended their campaigns. We'll look at how Wisconsin Republicans reacted.
In other news this week, the Wisconsin Department of Justice collected a record amount of old prescriptions during its drug take-back day, and an iconic war photo featuring a Wisconsinite, or possibly not, came under scrutiny.
Robert Menser joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So since we last spoke, we now have a presumptive nominee for the Republican Party, and this has put some Wisconsin Republicans, not all, but some, in a kind of a sticky position there about whether or not to support him. And Paul Ryan is one of those who hasn't kind of decided either way. But here's what he has to say so far.
You have said throughout this process that you will support the Republican presidential nominee. Now you have a presumptive nominee, Donald Trump. Will you support him?
Well, to be perfectly candid with you, Jake, I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now. And I hope to, though, and I want to, but I think what is required is that we unify this party.
This is Paul Ryan on CNN earlier this week. And Rob, what is your take about how other state Republicans are responding to Trump as the nominee?
Yeah, so this was the week that Trump clinched the nomination, or as Senator Ted Cruz dropped out of the race, John Kasich dropped out of the race. He's it. I think it was frankly kind of stunning, surprising at least, the speed at which a number of key Republicans have said, yeah, well, we can't have Hillary Clinton. So Trump wasn't my choice, but I'm with him now. There was a burgeoning Never Trump movement that Wisconsin was supposed, you know, there was once upon a time Wisconsin was supposed to be the turning point where conservatives, led by some conservative media figures and a lot of Wisconsin elected leaders, were trying to turn things toward Cruz, and it just didn't work out. So we already knew that Governor Scott Walker said he would support Trump if he was the nominee, and so it's somewhat surprising that of all Wisconsin political figures, Paul Ryan is the one who's holding out this week.
Why do you think it's surprising?
Well, I mean, you wouldn't. He's just sort of mild mannered in his tone, and though he was had given a speech addressing some of what he saw as problems with Trumpism, he wasn't really a leader of the sort of the Never Trump, Stomp Trump movement in Wisconsin. A lot of those more people who are really more involved in the day to day political campaigns in the state now are saying that they're behind him. You can even hear, though, in the way that Ryan talked about it in that clip, it's a bit of a question how much longer he'll be able to hold out with this position. He says, I'm not going to endorse him right now, but I hope to. They're meeting next week, so I think I would expect that even Paul Ryan is going to be on the Trump train pretty soon.
So why hold out? If you think that's the case, if you think he's going to have to cave, do you have any idea what he's waiting for?
Well, so there always has been the argument, what has become called the Never Trump argument, has been that because Trump is unpredictable, because he says crazy things, opinion polls show that he is very, very unpopular with some very big demographic groups, namely Hispanics and women, that it's a risk for the Republican Party to have him as their nominee. There's also an argument among conservatives that because Trump has not historically been sort of part of the conservative movement or tied to the Republican Party institutionally, that he may not be, sort of reliably conservative in the event that he is elected. So this was the argument that was made throughout the nominating process, that he is a risky nominee to have. He could affect down ballot races, and what's he going to do if he actually becomes president? But you know what? The guy got the most votes. I mean, he still was the most popular candidate in the Republican primaries. So here we are.
So, Rob, just briefly before we move on, we've got a question mark over Paul Ryan. Who else in the Wisconsin legislature has come down on one side or the other?
So there was a lot of institutional support in Wisconsin, first for Marco Rubio and then for Ted Cruz, who did win the Wisconsin primary. This week, after a caucus meeting, there was a report. Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald said, "We are on the Trump train now," and that was sort of the quote of the week. And in a lot of cases, a lot of the elected leaders who had been never Trump guys just sort of stayed quiet. They haven't issued any statements at all. What you read from that is they are allowing Fitzgerald to sort of speak for the Wisconsin Republican Party.
So in other news this week, the Wisconsin Department of Justice announced that they took in a record amount of unwanted prescriptions during its semi-annual drug take-back day. What kind of numbers are they reporting?
Yeah, so this is a bit of good news. They reported, Attorney General Brad Schimmel said 62,618 pounds of prescription drugs, which seems like a lot. It is more than 40% up from the last state take-back day in October, and that one itself had broken the state record. So it is definitely a sign that more people are participating in the events, and it's a good thing. The idea here, really what it really stems from, is an attempt to combat opiate addiction, and the argument is in a lot of cases people who end up addicted to heroin got their start from finding some old legal over-the-counter pills that are opiates. They find them in grandma's medicine cabinet or whatever, and they begin experimenting that way and end up sort of addicted to heroin.
And so news also came out recently in a related front that a UW professor believes that we're just at the tip of the iceberg for opiate issues in Wisconsin. Why would that be said?
Yeah, this is worrying, and it really has to do with the rates at which opiates are prescribed and the number of these prescriptions that are filled. Sometimes they're filled in quantities of 300 pills at a time or large numbers like that. And when that is the case, when those are sort of sloshing around the state, it's a major risk that people will themselves develop dependency, or that they sell, have a little side business selling some of those pills. And, as we've seen, opiate addiction is extremely powerful and scary, hard to kick once you're started.
We're talking with Robert Menster right now for our Wisconsin News Roundup. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. And finally, Robert, a story out this week that took 70 years in the making here. A former Wisconsin Marine may not actually be in an iconic World War II photo, the Iwo Jima photo. What is the story there?
Yes, this is maybe the most iconic image from World War II, certainly one of them. It is the image of U.S. Marines raising the American flag, sort of pushing to get the flag upright at the end of the Battle of Iwo Jima. So it's an iconic image, and for these many decades, John Bradley, a Navy man who was from Appleton and later lived in Antigo, the official story was that he was one of the guys in the photograph. There have been, for some years now, a couple of amateur historians who've raised the question about whether John Bradley actually was in that photo. And this week, the news was that the U.S. military is doing its own investigation of that claim. And Bradley's own son, James Bradley, has concluded that it's true. His father wasn't in the photo. Now, Bradley was in Iwo Jima, and he did raise a flag in Iwo Jima. But what they say is that there were two flags raised that day. And it looks like these people say that that John Bradley was involved in the first flag raising of the day, but the iconic photo is of the second.
Yeah, that's news to me. Is it to you that there were two flag raisings at the time of that photo?
Yeah, it's interesting, right? And a lot of the evidence stems from, for example, there's a letter that John Bradley sent home that talks about going to attending mass after the flag raising. This was something that he sent home only just a couple days after it happened, so that seems fairly reliable. And the idea is, if he went to mass after raising the flag, then he was probably involved in the first one. The second one happened in the afternoon. So, you know, the human memory is very suggestible. It's very unreliable, and we don't have evidence to suggest that Bradley, like, intentionally lied about this. He died in 1994. But, you know, I mean, it makes you think, right? If he wasn't in that photo, then who was? And hopefully if true, hopefully the U.S. military will be able to track down that person and get him the credit he deserves.
Well, Rob, thanks a lot. We'll see you next week.
All right. Thank you.
That was news editor Robert Menzer looking at the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest tells us how to cultivate resilience and why grit can be a key part of success or failure.
First, winds and dry conditions are causing a Canadian wildfire to grow. The fires in the province of Alberta have forced the evacuation of the entire city of Fort McMurray.
UW-Madison research meteorologist Scott Bachmeyer has a bird's-eye view of the fires. He uses satellite imaging to track local conditions and global impacts of major wildfires. Scott, welcome to the show.
My pleasure.
Well, Scott, this is a massive wildfire, as we're seeing in the headlines. Looking from your view from satellites, how big does this look?
It's a large one, but it's not the largest. I mean, we often see a lot of these in Canada. What is unusual and unfortunate about this one here is it happened right by a major urban area, so they had to evacuate over 80,000 people from that town. It was kind of unusual to have this begin as early as it happened. In early May, we don't expect to see a lot of these happen in Canada, but it's been extremely hot and dry in those provinces, and so it looks like things are off to an early start.
What do we learn from satellite imagery of this kind of major wildfire?
Well, as our instruments have improved, it makes it much easier for us to spot them and track their progress. And so if it happens to be by a major urban area, we can give an earlier heads up.
Now, I just encountered a phrase I'd never seen before, pyrocumulonimbus clouds. So a fire like this makes its own kind of clouds, is that right?
Makes a thunderstorm, actually, and the heat from these is so intense that it causes an updraft. These are quite impressive, and they happen quite often, actually.
And how far does the smoke and do the smoke plumes and clouds spread from a wildfire like this?
Well, it depends on what the flow is in the upper atmosphere. I mean, they can spread all the way around the planet, actually. In this particular case, we actually saw it did move over Wisconsin yesterday afternoon, and then towards the evening hours, we could actually see it over the coastal areas of, like, Alabama and even Florida. So it's gone a long distance.
Do those clouds have an impact on weather patterns, on the weather as far away as, say, the eastern United States?
I don't think that has an impact directly on our air quality because it is at high altitudes. It's obviously having a large impact on air quality in those provinces. You know, if they're, you know, 100 or 200 miles away, they are having major air quality problems. But for us, it's not a direct impact. You know, we'll see hazy skies, but it's at high altitudes.
Now, we've been talking big picture there. Does the satellite imaging actually help spot, I guess they call them hot spots, that helps with the firefighting effort?
Absolutely. As we have improvements in our instruments, we're able to see these hot spots a lot earlier, and we can accurately see, you know, how hot they actually are. And so I think that has helped, you know, if it's in an area where it can have an impact on people, we're able to offer an earlier heads up.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, absolutely.
That was UW-Madison research meteorologist Scott Bachmeyer, who's tracking the devastating fires in Alberta, Canada. Switching our focus now back to Wisconsin, in conjunction with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, today the National Weather Service issued a red flag warning for some northern counties in the state. Joining us for the latest on that is WPR reporter Rich Kramer from our Eau Claire Bureau. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Rich, hopefully we don't have to worry about anything as big as what's going on in Alberta here in Wisconsin. But what is this red flag warning here in the state?
Basically, it's a coordinated effort, as you mentioned, to let people know that we are at very high risk of fires to start and spread today, especially until 8 p.m., but also extremely high fire danger in the farther northern counties over the weekend.
Yeah, which counties are under this red flag warning?
Red flag warning includes Burnett, Douglas, Washburn, Sawyer, and Bayfield counties until 8 p.m. this evening.
And what kind of conditions are they looking at that are contributing to this warning?
Well, it's you know, it's warm. Right now it's about 90 degrees in Eau Claire. Farther north, it's right around the same temp, upper 80s. There's winds with some gusts to 20 miles an hour. But the main factor is the fuel sources. Up north, you know, they are a little slower to have the green foliage come up, the new fresh grass come up. So right now it's kind of that period between when the snow melts and when the green leafy stuff comes out, so there's a lot of fuel on the ground.
And I don't know how common these warnings are. This one caught our eye today just because of the wildfires in the news from Alberta. Do we see this kind of warning very often in the state?
Well, generally, they happen very, it's a very short period of time, and they usually happen in the spring when we have these really dry conditions because the snow is gone and the new green grasses and trees and bushes haven't come up yet. So it does happen, but generally it's in the spring. It's happening right about when it normally does.
And did the DNR give any kind of recommendations? Let's start with people in the outdoors. Some fishing season's getting ready to start around the state.
Right. So first off, for the red flag warning, the counties, and again, Burnett, Douglas, Washburn, Sawyer, and Bayfield counties, burning permits are completely suspended. They're also, the DNR is encouraging people not to have any fire source. Generally, you're allowed to have campfires for cooking and for heating, but they're discouraging even that. So what people can do is, you know, not lay off on the campfires if they can help it, and just be very careful. The DNR spokesperson that I talked to today said things like even chains dragging from a boat trailer, that can cause sparks that can ignite a wildfire. If you've got ATVs that you ride in the woods, be mindful. It's got a hot exhaust. Don't park it in any tall grass. It's common sense things.
Did I see recommendations for landowners as part of this warning?
Well, don't burn. If they have outdoor burn barrels, or if they're, a lot of people like to burn the leftover fallen branches and whatnot from the winter in the spring, but that is definitely not advised right now.
And I know they were definitely emphasizing that fishing seasons are starting, so they're trying to get that out there for this weekend. Do they have a duration in mind for how long these warnings are in place?
This red flag warning actually is expiring until at 8 p.m. tonight. But that said, I looked at the DNR fire danger map that they have. Very high fire danger in the state, in the northern part of the state. We're talking north of Vernon, Washara, and Brown counties, there's high fire danger in the southeast. Only the southwest part of the state is at moderate. So people need to be careful all around.
And so that's high fire danger, but red flag warning, just to get my level straight here, is even higher than that high risk warning.
Red flag warning is extreme fire danger. Tinderbox.
Right. Anything, any other words of advice that you got when you talked to the DNR, Rich?
Well, just be careful out there, they said. Be mindful of what you're doing. Put out any kind of ignition sources that you've got, including cigarettes and whatnot. They also said that this weekend there is some spotty rain possible in the northern counties here, but they don't think that that'll be enough to actually lower the fire dangers a whole lot. What they'll need is warmer temperatures up there and a lot of rain so that the green grasses will grow up. But at this point, we're just waiting for that foliage to come in.
Rich, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on that.
Thanks for having me.
Been talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter in our Eau Claire Bureau. He joins us to talk about wildfire warnings issued by the DNR and the National Weather Service. This red flag warning in effect, as he said, for the rest of the day. Also, high fire risk for many parts of the state. But that red flag warning, you're looking for that in counties like Douglas, Bayfield, Burnett, Washburn, and Sawyer County. That's to tonight. So if you're out fishing or camping this week, take very good care and no burning.
Coming up, our guest tells us why talent may be less important than grit for our success and happiness. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, political junkie Ken Rudin puts today's political news in perspective, including the latest on the Republican reaction to Donald Trump as the last candidate standing. That's tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, when it comes to success in school, in a career, in a sport, talent can go a long way, but it's not always enough. Often there's that turning point where things get tough and we have to decide, do we bail out or do we stick it out and keep plugging away?
Our next guest says that's a big part of success or failure, and a lot of times it comes down to perseverance, determination, and in a word, grit. And she shares her research on grit in her new book.
Angela Duckworth joins us now. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's author of the new book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this idea of grit, I think, conjures up something in everybody's mind, but can you put a definition on it? What is grit?
I think what it might conjure up in your mind is perseverance and hard work, resilience in the face of adversity. And I would half agree with you because perseverance is half of grit. But the other half of grit is just as important, and that is having a genuine passion, a genuine love for and sense of importance about a long-term goal.
And to get into the importance of it, you measured the grit of West Point cadets. Now, they're going through a challenging experience here. And you looked at whether they dropped out or stayed in and completed their training. And then you compared your grit measurements to the aptitude test that West Point itself did. So how important a predictor of success at West Point was grit?
That first summer of training, the summer that you're turned from a, you know, soft and squishy 18-year-old civilian into a future soldier and military leader, is affectionately known as Beast, even in official West Point literature. Beast, because it's that hard. And you're right, every year, even though these young men and women are highly selected for their physical aptitude, their intellectual capacity, et cetera, there are more cadets that drop out than people might imagine. And what I found is that your grit score, which is how you score on a simple questionnaire of how much passion and perseverance you tend to have for long-term goals, your grit score is a resoundingly accurate predictor of whether you're going to make it through Beast. And in comparison, what West Point calls their whole candidate score, a kind of composite of your various aptitudes, including physical and intellectual, that ends up not predicting at all who's going to make it through Beast.
It seems a little counterintuitive because you might think if someone's good at a thing, whether it's getting ready to be a soldier or music or math or whatever, if they've got that raw talent, they're going to coast on through no problem. But what I'm hearing you say is no, that's just not enough.
Well, I've always been surprised a little bit, I guess, by this finding that talent doesn't make it easier for you to stick with things, because after all, if you are more talented, you get so much out of all the time that you spend doing something. It turns out that talent is no protection against quitting things early, and it's also no guarantee that you'll really work on your weaknesses, continually work to improve in what you do.
So grit, you've talked about measuring it. How do we measure this really intangible property?
One way I've measured grit is through this grit scale that I mentioned. I can say a little bit about how it came to be. I was doing interviews with really high achievers. I mean, think of them as super achievers in fields as diverse as art and politics and music, commerce. This is early on in my study of grit. And almost verbatim, I actually translated the things that those super achievers would tell me about the people that they most admired into the grit scale. Now, people also, by the way, mentioned talent, luck, an opportunity, but I was not measuring those in my grit scale. That's to say that these other factors are, in fact, important. But the questions that I have on the scale, like I finish whatever I begin, I'm a hard worker, and questions about the consistency of interests over time, they really come from those interviews. A lot of my research is based on that questionnaire.
Talking to Angela Duckworth. Her new book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Well, I want to break down those two parts of grit. You mentioned earlier part of it is the perseverance. What is it that determines if somebody has that quality? They encounter obstacles, they don't give up, they keep going.
You know, for about 50 years, there's been a growing science of what you could call resilience or what you could also call hope. And it tells us this, that when people give up things, it's often because they believe at some very deep level that they simply can't be successful. And if you don't think that you're going to be successful at something, then, of course, it's rational to give up. Now, the question is, why are some people optimistic about what they can do in a situation and other people pessimistic about what they can do? If you then trace back the roots of optimism and pessimism, you often find that people are carrying around in their heads these kind of private theories about the way the world works, so, you know, theories of human nature. Some people have a growth mindset. Deep down, they believe that abilities, people's natures can change and grow. Other people have a fixed mindset. They might believe that your abilities, your talents, who you are, your personality, it's pretty much fixed. You know, you can't change a, you know, old dog, teach them new tricks. So what we find in our research is that people who are gritty tend to have a growth mindset, not a fixed one, and they're the ones who think optimistically about adversity.
Well, I wonder if you can change from one to the other, because if you're in that camp that says we're fixed, we can't change, step one is you'd have to persuade them that they can change to that more growth-oriented perspective. Can it be done?
It can. I think it's really important to point out that these theories kind of reinforce themselves. You know, Henry Ford is often quoted as saying, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. You always prove yourself right, particularly, for example, if you have a fixed mindset and you're a pessimist, you might say, well, there's really nothing I can do here, so I'm not going to try, and it's going to end in failure. And then that's exactly what happens, which is that you don't try and you fail and you prove yourself right. Alternatively, if you have a growth mindset, you think, you know, there's something I can do here. Maybe I can change. Maybe my abilities in this domain, math, for example, basketball, whatever it is that you're trying, maybe I can grow. Then you put forth some effort and you show yourself that, in fact, change is possible. The question is, how do you move someone from a fixed mindset to a growth one? And what my colleague Carol Dweck, who really takes the credit for creating this science of growth mindset, she's a psychologist at Stanford University, and we collaborate, we talk. What we found together in our own data is that, yes, growth mindset leads to grit, but what she's found in her intervention research is that you can change a mindset, in particular, by essentially proving to people that the truth is that human nature is malleable. She does this by showing you pictures of neurons growing, making new synaptic connections. Those things are scientific facts, and she's very persuasive about explaining how, yes, you might start off with a fixed mindset, but once you discover these new truths, you can be convincing of yourself that it's worthwhile considering a growth mindset.
So we can persuade people to believe that their brains can change by showing them images of brains changing.
You know, that's part of it. But if you actually look at her interventions, there's also persuasive quotes. For example, you know, she'll get testimonials from, say, second-year college students who say to the first-year college students, you know, when I first got to college, I thought, you know, I'm never going to get the hang of this. There are people who are meant to be here and people who aren't. But I, you know, learned from my own experience that I was wrong about that. And when I started trying, you know, dot, dot, dot. So it's not just pictures of brains. It's testimonials and other things that, you know, more than 50 years of psychological science has proven to be effective. And there's a lot of kind of technical, psychological expertise that goes into making these interventions as effective, as potent as they really are.
We've been talking about the perseverance side of the equation, that half of grit. Let's get to the other side, the passion and the purpose. A lot of times you hear the advice, do what you love for a career, which isn't always possible, but we can kind of meet that halfway, it sounds like, to find purpose. How do we do that?
You know, I've never been to a commencement speech, I think, that didn't have something along the lines of follow your passion, do what you love. This is probably because most of the people who stand up at the podium at commencement speeches are themselves incredibly successful. And it is certainly true that those individuals do love what they do. In fact, they use those exact words, I love what I do. Now, if you don't have something that you love, what's your situation? What advice do we have for you? I think the first thing to recognize is that these passions typically develop over time. I mean, if you look at Julia Child as just one example, she says in her autobiography that for much of her life, she had, quote, zero interest in the stove, unquote. Now, how did it happen that Julia figured out finally that she wanted to become a cookbook author? Well, it took time. She moved to France with her husband at that early point. She didn't know whether she was going to end up in cooking at all. They had a few terrific meals at French restaurants that led to more terrific meals at bistros and cafes. She started wandering around the streets of Paris, seeing the beautiful produce and the wonderful bread. She decided that she would start to read about cooking. She got a cookbook from a friend. Her husband bought her a second one. That led to classes. Those classes led to more classes. One really important thing to realize about how most people figure out their passion is that it's a process of active discovery, and it really does take time.
We're talking to Angela Duckworth about her new book. It's called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you think hard work and perseverance are more important than talent? Did you get through an experience at work, maybe in school and sports and the military, by sticking with it even when you wanted to give up? And do you have questions about how to learn or to teach grit? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Angela Duckworth about her new book called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How important is grit, resilience, stick-to-itiveness? Has it been a part of your life? Did someone maybe teach you a lesson in determination that stuck with you to this day? And how did you find a purpose to go along with that perseverance? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Christopher is with us in Verona. Christopher, hi.
Hi, how are you? So I have a question about kind of like the, perhaps the dark side. How do you know when to stop being persistent, when this grit isn't working? Like, For example, I just feel like I went to graduate school. It didn't work out the first time. I came back, did it again. I finally got it. But in the process, I also got burned out, and now I don't want to do it anymore. So in my field of study. So I'm wondering, like, how do you know the difference between when it's time to quit and when is it really just a matter of being a little more persistent?
Great question, Christopher. When is it grit? When is it beating your head against the wall, Angela?
It is a great question and not an easy one ever to personally negotiate, right? But here's some general advice. You know, I'd ask you why you went to graduate school. And the reason I start that question with why is that when you ask yourself why questions, you essentially go a level up in your goal hierarchy. When you ask yourself how, you go down a level. And by that goal hierarchy, this is what I mean. All of us have things that we want to do, but you can organize these things in levels. when you talk about high-level goals, they're kind of the ultimate whys. You know, like, I go to graduate school because I really care about psychology and I want to help people through psychology. Okay, in that case, are there other ways that you could help people through psychology other than that particular PhD program, if that's what you were in? I think by going up a level to the, why am I doing this anyway, it gives us a little bit of perspective. It allows for some flexibility in decision-making. Sometimes when we go up a level, we realize that that lower-order goal isn't the only way that we can achieve what we're really after.
Christopher, thanks for that call. And Angela, that really illustrates your point that grit isn't just the perseverance side that we think of. It's the perseverance plus that passion or purpose.
Yeah, and when I talk about really mature paragons of grit, I call them real exemplars of passion and perseverance, you know, they really do have these top-level goals that give meaning to everything else that they do. It's the top-level goal. For me, I'll give you my example, use psychological science to help kids thrive. That top-level goal is something that I intend never to revise, but the lower-level goals that help me get there, I can be very flexible about.
And one of the ways you've done that in your career is you were a teacher for a while, and that leads me to something I definitely wanted to ask you. How can we cultivate, teach grit for kids?
I'm still figuring that out, and I don't want to tell people that I have all the answers. There is no grit curriculum, you know, click here, you know, four easy steps to make your classroom into a grit classroom. I wish I had those answers, but I don't. What I can say is that knowing the science, you know, knowing that interests take years to develop, knowing that interests tend to precede the kind of disciplined, deliberate practice that really makes you better at any skill, knowing that purpose, having a sense of meaning and understanding what that really means psychologically, I think that all of these insights can inform classroom practice. If I were still in the classroom teaching math, which is what my subject area was, I would love to know those things so that when I went in there on Monday morning, I'd be able to say things differently. When I graded the test, maybe, you know, phrase my feedback very carefully. When I put up homework assignments, maybe give kids an idea of how when they went to study, they could be more effective. We're a really long way from having the answers all laid out from us, but I do think we're already at the point scientifically where we can at least inform educators about what we think is helpful and what we think is not.
Go back to our callers now with Jenny on the line in Milwaukee. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, what do I do to get to, I'm kind of in between the two ends, but more towards the getting it done and accomplishing, but I stop short of that for many different things. And how do I push myself to accomplishing the goal or the certification or whatever it is? I don't know why, if it's because fear of what do I do, what happens next, or, you know, people find out that I feel sometimes that people might find out that I don't know what I'm doing. Hmm. How do I get to pushing to the point of feeling good about doing it and finishing?
Jenny, thanks a lot for that call. Angela, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific question. I have a lot of empathy for it because, you know, we've all been there, really. We really all have. You know, one of the things that's a resonant theme when I speak to coaches, and I'm talking about coaches who are coaching world-class athletes, you know, Olympic athletes or professional football league, professional basketball, NBA, you know, that one of the themes that comes out when you talk to coaches or CEOs, you know, it's that the really valuable thing to remember in all of this is that mistakes provide information. You know, when you say the wrong thing, when you screw up, when you give a PowerPoint presentation and nobody can read your slides, that's information. That failure carries lots of valuable information. By the way, when you're successful, when you give a great PowerPoint presentation or you say the right thing, that's also information, and you can learn from that too. What you have to do is realize that whether you succeed or whether you fail, there's something to be learned. And rather than worry that you're a loser or just hope that you're a winner, be confident that you're always a learner. And maybe that's more important than anything at all.
Thanks a lot for your call, Jenny. Good luck to you. We're talking to Angela Duckworth. Her new book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. We'll go to another caller now at 800-642-1234 with Tucker on the line in Madison. Tucker, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I heard your speaker talk about her top-level goal of helping children through psychology. And I'm graduating from college next year, and I wondered when she discovered that that was her top-level goal. And the reason I ask is because I think I've sort of discovered something that I intend to spend the next many years working on, but I've thought that 10 times in the last few years.
It is quite, let me reassure you that it is quite typical that in your 20s there's a lot of experimentation and there is a lot of quitting, frankly, as you figure out what you ultimately want to stick with. I didn't go to graduate school for psychology until I was 32. That, by the way, was not my plan. I would have loved to have gotten started earlier, but I really didn't know that that was my direction. I took a while to figure out that, yes, I cared about kids, but no, I didn't want to play the role of the master teacher in their life. Though I, of course, myself benefited personally from having master teachers. I at one point thought I wanted to be a school principal and then decided I didn't want to do that. At one point I thought it would be through running a nonprofit. Nope, wasn't that either. So it took me a lot of years of kind of experimenting, figuring out what didn't work. But I think here's the thing to keep in mind. It's a little bit like dating, or at least for me. You know, I dated a lot of guys before I married my husband. As soon as I figured out that we weren't going to get married, I dropped the boyfriend. I was like, okay, done. I'm moving on. I was kind of dating with the intention of finding someone with whom I could settle down for life. And I think in terms of finding your calling, it's a little bit the same way. So don't be afraid to quit. But if you're merely quitting one thing, going to the next, without any intention of finding a calling, well, then I think you're never going to do that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tucker. I wanted to ask, at one point in the book, you say grit can help us be successful on a career path. Can you also talk about happiness, though? What's the relationship between grit and happiness?
I find in my data that the grittier you are, also the more satisfied you are with your life and the more positive emotion you are. So for short, I could say the grittier you are, on average, the happier you are. But I want to point out that happiness and grit are not the same exact thing. I mean, in theory, you could be gritty and unhappy, or the converse. I just want to say that in my data, you don't see this huge trade-off where, you know, really gritty people are accomplished but miserable. I also want to say that it's not that success and grit are the only important things to worry about in life. I think leading a life of integrity, of moral standards that you really believe in, having relationships with your family and friends, I mean, these things are separate from our objective achievements, but for many people, they're more important. I've got two girls at home, one's 13 and one's 14, and if I were forced to decide between them being gritty or good, I would absolutely pick good.
We'll leave it there, Angela. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Angela Duckworth. She's professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Grit, The Power and Passion of Perseverance. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.